I'm also appreciative of Angel not being here so I can have just a few more minutes, because what I'm going to try to fit into 15 minutes, maybe I can slow down just a little teeny bit. So what I will present today is a strategic initiative to secure access to and provision of second trimester abortion care in the United States. I'm going to talk a little bit about how we came to that work, and I will give you just a teaser of some of the recommendations for moving forward. Obviously, I can't go into all of them, but in the break or when we're in our discussion, if you want to talk about other kinds of strategies, I can do that. I have no financial disclosures to relationships to disclose, but I should say that there may be off-label conversations of the use of Digoxin, mifepristone, or misoprostol in the use of abortion, although we do not endorse any particular clinical protocols, and I won't be talking about that from a clinical perspective, only from a use perspective. So I just want to give a brief history of second trimester abortion. Kate and I were laughing before the panel that I just thought at the last minute I should actually add some slides about second trimester. We spend all of our time sort of midway in a conversation about second trimester abortion, and sometimes it's important to back up and to make sure that we're all on the same page in sort of our knowledge of that. So the legal framework for the concepts of trimesters in the law was created in 1973 in the Roe v. Wade decision, which made a distinction between what the government could do according to trimesters. So in the first trimester, the government could not regulate abortion under any circumstances. In the second trimester, the government could regulate abortion in the name of promoting women's health, the health of the pregnant person. And post-viability, which is somewhere in the third trimester, approximately 24 weeks, that itself is a contested issue, states could prohibit except in cases necessary to preserve a woman's health or life. So there is an exception even in post-viability abortions. This is how we came to know it, and in part why we came to understand our data and our policy work in this sort of trimester framework. What we can do in the first trimester, what we can do in the second trimester, and what we can do post-viability or in the third trimester. Now, that radically changed in 1992 in the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision, which in a sense eliminated in the law the first and second trimester distinction. So what became that sort of what you could do in the first and what you could do in the second went away, and states could regulate abortion as long as those regulations didn't impose an undue burden on the woman seeking an abortion. Now, what is an undue burden has been the topic of conversation for all subsequent legal cases after 1992. But this notion that you do something different in the first and the second trimester in the law no longer exists. And what we find interesting is as you have a conversation about policy and clinical and research, we really need to deconstruct how we have come to understand second trimester abortion. Because having an abortion in the 15th week may look more like having an abortion in the 11th week than having an abortion in the 21st week. That there are big differences that happen at the clinical level across the continuum of second trimester abortion. And so perhaps this framework is no longer the framework we need to think about services. So what is a second trimester abortion? Most abortions are done in the first trimester, about 90%. Most of those are done via medication, misoprostol and mifepristone, or aspiration abortion with suction. As you advance into the second trimester, more is needed to dilate the cervix safely and to extract the growing fetal tissue. So that the most common technique in the United States is dilation and evacuation, and those are sort of broadly defined in two categories between sort of intact dilation and extraction, what some people call DNX, which is the sort of topic that got talked about in the so-called partial birth abortion discussion, and Kate will talk later in her presentation about the sort of misunderstandings, and then inductions, using medications to induce women to have a miscarriage. Now, in all the work that's been done subsequent to the big discussion around partial birth abortion is we've come to understand that these kinds of blanket categorizations, this is a disarticulation DNE, this is an intact DNE, this is an induction, do not exist at a clinical level. That the clinician uses a variety of techniques depending on the fetal presentation, their own surgical skill, the medical indications of the woman, the woman's preference, and that this sort of continuum of care is what we need to understand rather than this concept of distinct procedures. And there are a number of abortion providers in the room, and I think that It took them a long time to explain to the legal community and to the advocacy community that it was really about their technical skill and what they needed to do in the course of an abortion rather than what they set out to do at the beginning. Although clearly they have a game plan for the abortion. But that these distinct identities become problematic in the law, and I will talk about that. The technical difficulty of an abortion dramatically increases as the gestational age incurs. And so when we talk about who does a 14-week abortion and who does an abortion at 23 weeks, those are very different surgical skills. And so efforts to secure access or to offer provision need to recognize this sort of real distinction that occurs at a clinical level. Also, as you move up in the gestational ages into the second trimester, the procedure can take several days. You may need time to dilate the cervix slowly over time in order to extract the pregnancy safely without hurting her cervix. And so what you can do in a single day procedure in the first trimester, later in the second trimester, you may need multiple days. Now, obviously, if you're thinking about it, the problem with multiple days is that if the cervix is not anywhere near your home, there's an overnight issue. And so the obstacles and the logistics of getting an abortion become increasingly difficult just as the surgical capability does. And so does the cost. So in the 2005 Guttmacher study, I think that what you're going to be presenting a little bit on from that data, the median price for a 20-week abortion is about $1,200, and that's about three times the cost of a 10-week abortion. So the cost also goes up dramatically, which is a large obstacle and impediment, and gets women sort of on a cycle of trying to get enough money together to be ahead of the curve when they go to get their services. So how common is second trimester abortion? There's about 1.2 million abortions every year in this country. About 90%, think of that, are in the first trimester, but that still leaves about 120,000 abortions in the second trimester. This is not an insignificant number of healthcare services that need to be offered. And if you think about the number of, now this is not distinct women because some women have multiple second trimester abortions, but about 45 million second trimester abortions have been performed in the United States since 1973. Again, not an inconsequential number for us to sort of ignore and say this is just a, as people like to say, a wedge issue or a specialty service, but a real common. Now, what we don't understand about second trimester abortion is that while we're seeing, and I think Larry will talk more about this, a declining trend, that is more abortions in the first trimester happening earlier and earlier in the first trimester, the percentage of abortions that occur in the second trimester appears to be staying somewhat constant. And I'll just give you, this is data from the CDC, which sort of show you that despite the fact that in the first trimester more abortions are happening earlier in the first trimester, that is not at 12 weeks but at 9 weeks, not at 11 weeks but at 6 weeks. In the second trimester, there's something else going on that we need to understand. I'm not going to go into what the literature has said to us about the reasons women have second trimester abortion because Larry will talk about that in much more detail, but just to recognize there's a variety of reasons, but it is a place where we don't yet have enough or sufficient data. So, why focus on second trimester abortion? Why, do all of you sit in here as opposed to out there in the beautiful sunset? And I would think that because many of us understand that second trimester is fundamentally a health disparities issue, both at the delivery level and at the level of who in the population obtains second trimester abortion. And disparity issues are a lot about why we stay in public health and what we think we can make a difference. I'm also interested in this because our country as a whole, and in particular the pro-choice, and I put movements here because there is no single sort of monolithic pro-choice movement. There are a variety of pro-choice movements. There's a provider movement, there's a justice movement, there's a rights movement. But all of those movements seem to have some discomfort, ambivalence, and misinformation about second trimester abortion. And so even amongst friends, we don't have a way of talking about this issue. That public support for first trimester abortion is very high. We often hear this is a pro-choice nation. Most people believe that abortion should be legal, even with some restrictions. But that data is very different when one talks about access to second trimester abortion. And then lastly, that second trimester abortion is particularly vulnerable to political influences and restrictions. That is in part because there's no public support, and even within pro-choice movements, there's not adequate support. So this area of healthcare is very vulnerable to being sold out, and I just wanted to share a little bit about why I think that my paranoia might have some basis. So William Salatin, who's considered a friend of the pro-choice movement, he writes for the Washington Post, he's written for Slate, argued in 2006, maybe the six-month window made more sense in 1973 than it does today. Maybe if we spent more the next 10 years helping women avoid second trimester abortions, we wouldn't have to spend the next 20 to 40 years defending them. So what's embedded into this, if you sort of unpack what Salatin is saying here, is that somehow the legal availability of second trimester abortion threatens the legal support for all abortions, and that somehow it's the women in the second trimester that somehow need to be manipulated into getting their abortions in the first trimester so that we can sort of depoliticize abortion. Now, I would argue that the real polar extremes on abortion in this country are not about whether or not you can have an abortion at 8 weeks or at 14 weeks. They're really about whether or not you can have an abortion at all. So there is discomfort in the middle. But I would argue that the polarization, the sort of real animosity that our country has about abortion doesn't come from that uncertainty. It comes from these extremes. So I think that he's looking for a solution for politicization off the backs of women who get second trimester abortions, and I'm not sure that that would lend itself to any sort of theory of change. But he's not alone. I was at Yale Law School for a legal conference a couple weeks ago on the future of sexual and reproductive rights in the law. These are the legal constitutional scholars who study everything sort of around this, LGBT rights, sexuality rights, abortion rights. And Michael Klarman, who's an author of a new book coming out on backlash, in his comments about Roe, said that the addition of second trimester abortion to Roe, that is the decision by black men to extend that beyond 12 weeks, was largely symbolic. That those 45 million abortions that have occurred are sort of silent in our understanding of the need for abortion, and that somehow, again, if we just backed up the gestational limit, we could have more sort of grand support for abortion rights. And the solution to this issue is not coming anytime soon. If people watched the third presidential debate, they asked Barack Obama what his position was on abortion, and he responds with what are, in a sense, the pro-choice talking points on this issue. With respect to partial birth abortion, I am completely supportive of a ban of late-term abortions. Partial birth or otherwise, in other words, it's not just about the technique, it's about the gestational age, as long as there's an exception for the woman's health or life, and this did not contain that exception. So he's talking about why he vetoed or why he did not support a particular partial birth abortion ban. Now, what's interesting here is that, of course, the concept of late term is not defined, right? So he's speaking in ambiguities to an audience that he knows to be somewhat uncomfortable with this. Well, what do we mean by late-term abortion? In 1999, David Grimes, who's considered a sort of scholar in our field and certainly a leading expert in obstetrics and gynecology, articulated that late-term abortion are those above 21 weeks. So is that what Barack Obama means here? Does he mean that he supports a ban, regardless of the technique, not just the so-called DNX procedure, but all techniques, at above 21 weeks? Or does he mean what many of us think it means, which is abortions in the third trimester? Does he mean it for post-viable or for viable abortions? So the ambiguity that's being exploited here, I think, for those of us who want to believe that he is a supporter of women's right to abortion, we read it differently. Those who oppose abortion read something else into it. And I think what's going to be important in the next 4-8 years, if he wins, is to really understand this issue and to really go at it at a public policy level. Because if he's talking about 21-week abortions, he's talking about a particularly vulnerable group of women. And I think what Dr. Foster will help you understand is that these are real people. These are not symbolic issues in a sort of political war of philosophies. These are, you know, real women's lives that are affected when these kinds of regulations happen. So given all of this, we thought that it was important to try to bring together a group of people who thought about and had a stake in second trimester abortion to put forward a national initiative to try to secure access, that is, to stop being reactive, but potentially to be proactive on how to do this. Why a strategic initiative? I just need to have something else on my slides besides words. And that's because, you know, the old adage that we only see one part of the elephant. You know, I see Dr. Hearn here, and, you know, he's going to see it from a clinician's perspective. I'm going to see it through a sociologist lens. The lawyers in the room are going to see it through the legal lens. And only when we bring all of those perspectives together can we have a rich enough understanding about what it means to make social transformation, because that's really what's needed. We need to get people to understand that second trimester abortion is here to stay, that women deserve it, that women shouldn't be stigmatized about it, it should be accessible, it should be paid for, all of those kinds of things that we have come to understand about other kinds of healthcare, you know, but this kind of healthcare is somehow different. The strategic initiative has, you know, five components: to collect what we know about second trimester abortion, to identify the knowledge gaps, to develop some strategic recommendations, to share these recommendations, to refine those recommendations, and hopefully to move forward with a unified vision. We have a national advisory committee that's made up of sort of all of the sectors that we think are included, but many more people have given their input into this. There are four areas in the strategic initiative: law and policy, service delivery, research, and communications. I'm going to go through each of these briefly, but again, recognizing that these are sort of very robust sets of recommendations, of which I'm only going to tease you with a little bit. We started with a survey of advocates and providers. We wanted to find out what people in this field who do this work thought of a number of things. From that, we developed a white paper with the status of what we know, as well as what was known in the literature and what people knew from their experiential activities. That was distributed to over 100 individuals who refined those findings, who gave more input, and then that refined white paper was shared at a two-day summit of 45 attendees representing the sort of multi-sectors that I just discussed, and they produced a set of recommendations that will start moving forward an actual action plan. So on the service delivery side, there's a number of key questions. Those are both those that we need to address today and those that we need to determine for the future. And these are some of the kinds of questions that we were interested in. How are the services distributed? And this, I think, Larry has really done more work than we actually thought he would be capable of doing, and he's going to tell you a little bit about the answer to that question. You know, how do women access these services? How do physicians gain skills? How do facilities make decisions about what gestational limits they go to, and, you know, why do physicians continue to provide this care in spite of a hostile environment? Like, what drives people to actually continue to do that kind of day-to-day work that women need? Yeah. So the kinds of questions that were in the online survey include things like, at what week in a woman's pregnancy does it become difficult in your state to access abortion care? We wanted to try to understand where the sort of natural markers were in the current access to care. And you can see here that there seems to be something about 18 weeks. After 18 weeks, a significant number of women, people believed, had trouble accessing care. So then we started looking at post-18-week services. Is there something different we can understand about those? Again, hearkening back to my earlier comments about deconstructing that second trimester abortion and really understanding it in the continuum of at a clinical care level. I'm not going to go into this because Larry will do it, but it demonstrates that there is a distribution at weeks that's very different across the country, and it may have to do with having one provider, having several providers, but difficult to understand. So again, this is sort of where they are located in the country, but then the other question is, you know, why do people choose the gestational limit that they go to? Unlike providers in the first trimester, who most of whom go to the end of the first trimester, abortion providers in the second trimester might only go to 16 weeks, another one may go to 19 weeks, somebody else may go to 22, and somebody may go into the post-viability. And we wanted to understand sort of what those are, and you'll see four factors that we focused our strategic work on. The lack of surgical skills and comfort, or that's where they felt like they should, personal beliefs about where they should be, facilities policies. About a third of those who responded said that it was their facility and not themselves, not the clinician themselves, that determined the gestational limit, and that state regulations, almost about 40% of people said that the determination of gestational limits was made by their state regulations. So sort of that was the data collection phase. There's a lot more data in the white paper, but the moving forward, it was sort of, okay, given this, can we make some recommendations? And I'm sorry that Angel's not here, because this is the work that she's been doing around this, is to understand, can we have a rational distribution services? Given what we understand that this, the access points seem to be somewhere at 18 weeks, you know, how many providers do we actually need? Where should they be located? How long should women have to travel? And all of those kinds of things. As well as what can we do to help providers, not those who have made the decision, or perhaps even those who have made a decision about a gestational age based on the surgical skill, but are there ways to help people move up the gestational limit, or to remove some of those either state-based or institutional-based barriers that limit the gestational age of the abortion that they can provide? So, I'm sorry to say that we haven't done a public announcement of our innovative recommendations, in part because our slides are public, and this is a strategic move to try to get some change in second trimester abortion, and so revealing all of our strategies might not be the wisest activity. But just to give you a sort of tease, one of the things that people are working on looking at is, you know, where should regional hubs be? And regional hubs, can you package services that include housing, food, transportation, and services, such that women, the entire cost of the abortion can really be understood? And can you cost that out in a way that makes it both financially affordable for the providers to do and for the women to obtain? And what kinds of financial support should we have? So then where should those be located? In looking particularly at geographic limitations, you know, it's one thing to drive 6 hours across a plane. It's another thing to drive 2 hours over a mountain. So the number of sort of hours of travel doesn't make a lot of sense when you look at the topography of the United States. We may need a different kind of distribution. So on the law and policy side, you know, again, how secure is the judicial framework for second trimester abortion? And that's about sort of what is the legal backstopping on abortion? What government laws impede provision? What institutional policies impede provision? And what are the consequences of those impediments? So the kinds of things that we're looking at are procedure bans, and Kate will talk about the first study that we did that looked at what effect the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003 had on providers. We've done a study looking at trap laws. These are facility-based requirements that require you to have a certain kind of physical plant, a certain kind of nursing staffing, those kinds of requirements. Healthcare refusal clauses, what happens when people say they won't offer care. Then there's also general malpractice and general liability restrictions. Providers who want to do that, their malpractice provider says you can't do it, and institutional policies. Again, just to give you a little bit of data on the kinds of things that we're finding, so Kate will talk about procedure bans, but this is a law that was passed, a trap law that was passed in Texas in 2003, and what you can see is that as of 2006, the number of abortions performed after the 16th week, that's when the trap law, the facility plant requirements, staffing requirements go into effect, you have about a 54% reduction in the number of abortions that occur in Texas. What we don't know is, do they go to Oklahoma, do they go to Louisiana, or do they not get abortions? And I think that, again, what you'll hear from Dr. Foster is that when you can't get an abortion, it's a very real, material, tangible effect for women. And so these numbers need to be rounded out with the real stories of women. So what are questions? One is there a different kind of judicial or legal framework that we need to be developing to protect second trimester abortion? Is privacy really it? Is it a balancing between fetal rights and women's rights? Is there, Reva Siegel, who's at the Yale Law School, is looking at things around dignity. Human rights frames are looking at issues of stigma. Lots of other ways to think through securing it that is beyond just the Roe framework. So again, we have a long list of innovative regulations, but one that I just wanted to point out, because I think it's the kind of thing that this group could get actively involved in, is to train advocates who are facile in the discussion of second trimester abortion to work with key stakeholders at the state level, as well as public policy advocates at the federal level. So to work with our friends to help them understand the importance of second trimester abortion and to talk about it in a real way that doesn't say things like, I'm against late term abortion, you know, partial birth or otherwise, unless there's a health exception. On the communication side, this is probably the most difficult piece of it. There's both an internal and an external communication strategy that's needed. In other words, how do we talk to the movements, those people who are supportive of abortion, but also how do we understand the external or the public's opinion on abortion? So these are from the Gallup polls, and they've been sort of consistent across the years. You see widespread support for legal abortion in the first trimester, but that drops dramatically in the second trimester of pregnancy. So only about 25 or about a quarter of the public believe that abortion should be legal in the second trimester. And again, we haven't unpacked that. We don't know if that means 25 weeks or if that means 10 weeks, I mean 14 weeks. But it does mean that we have a large public opinion problem. So what do we do? You know, how do we determine our communications priorities? Do we do public relations? Do we do media? Do we work with the justice? Do we internal, external? These kinds of things about how do we move forward with a communications strategy? And I think that when we started this work, many people wanted to go immediately to the telling of women's stories, as that they thought that was the strategy to do it. And I think what the communications folks have helped us draw back on is to say, first and foremost, perhaps what we need to do is understand what happens to the people who go from support in the first trimester to support in the second trimester. So these are people we're not converting on the issue of abortion, right? These are people who are supportive of abortion, but something happens for them in that transformation, and can we understand that? And in that place, is there some place to move forward around support rather than a big, you know, sort of national campaign to promote second trimester abortion? On the research side, all of the areas so far have research recommendations, but we also wanted a research agenda that paralleled the other strategies, but some of which would be research questions that we think are important to evaluate success. And we focused those in really three areas. How do you improve the quality of care? That is incredibly important, and I think Dr. Hearn has, you know, spoken to me a number of times about this, on this issue, that it's not just about getting access, it's about getting access to quality healthcare. And so we need to make sure that we keep our eyes on quality healthcare and that we don't lose that in just getting people access to services. How do we advocate for good public policy? What is good public policy? Fighting all regulation may not be good public policy. We may actually think that in the 24th week of pregnancy, a nurse observer in a room, a nurse assistant during the time of recovery, is a good quality healthcare services. And so it's about sort of moving out of our place of always resisting regulation and really thinking about what is good, what is evidence-based public policy, and then what do we do to increase access? What's really needed to make this real for women? And again, you're sort of thinking about these innovative recommendations. There's a number of small studies that we've taken on, but one of the most important that'll be moved forward is sort of a large scale study looking at the complications of second trimester abortion to really understand what the consequences are about how you provide care, you know, what kinds of techniques get used, what kinds of cervical preparations happen, those kinds of things, so that we know that if recommendations are made about a clinical care service, that those in fact are based in evidence. So I've given you a little bit of teaser and convinced you to go out and make a little cocktail conversation about second trimester abortion. Great.
Next, we're going to have Dr. Larry Feiner, who's the Director of Domestic Research at the Guttmacher Institute. In that role, he's responsible for supervising their research portfolio for U.S.-focused projects on family planning services, contraceptive use patterns, pregnancy and abortion, and adolescent reproductive health, so all the issues near and dear to our hearts. And he also has responsibilities such as updating U.S. estimates of unintended pregnancy, and the census that the Guttmacher Institute does of abortion providers, which is very important to filling out our understanding of how many abortions go on in the United States. Dr. Feiner.
All Okay, well, hello everybody, and since Tracy covered so much of my presentation, I'm just going to say thank you and I'll take any questions.